Red Eyes Creations Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren. Good to have you with us, and thank you for tuning in. We are recording this program from Sweden in Scandinavia, but wherever you are around the world, you can find us online at our website, redicecreations.com, R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com. Good to have you here. Hope you're settled in for another program. Today we have Jerry E. Smith back with us on the show. We've had Jerry with us before, so if you remember, he is the author of Secrets of the Holy Lance, or Secret of the Holy Lance, Harp, the Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, and Weather Warfare. And today I thought we could discuss a little bit about both of his book, Harp and Weather Warfare, and a little bit about how this actually ties in to the global conspiracy, if you will, and the emerging scenario of the world of government control, etc., etc. So it's going to be very interesting hearing more about Jerry regarding these matters. Jerry's website, by the way, is jerryesmith.com. jerryesmith.com, where you can find a lot more information about his books and his research. So it's a pleasure having you back on the program, Jerry. Thank you for coming on.
Well, hi, good to be with you again.
Excellent. You know, I do want to ask you a little bit about, I don't know if that's a good place to start or not, but I want to ask you a little bit about Jim Keith. As I understand it, you were a close associate and friend to him, and I also wanted to tie this in, I guess, a little bit about his research and of course, your own research, and maybe how the two dovetails, and also a little bit background on Jim Keith and potentially what could have happened to him, so to speak. What do you think, Jerry?
Sure. Jim Keith was my best friend from 1966. We met in high school up until his untimely death in 1999. He died a few days before his 50th birthday. Jim and I worked together off and on throughout that whole 30-year period. In the 60s, we did a number of amateur publications together, some of which received rather high critical acclaim in the science fiction fantasy community. We both wanted to grow up to become science fiction authors, and sometime in the 80s, we discovered that we had a talent for nonfiction, and Jim produced a dozen books of nonfiction, and I helped write about a third of them in one way or another. We were working on we'd done a number of semi-professional publications in the 70s and 80s, shopper newspapers and small circulation magazines, and one of the small circulation magazines was Dharma Combat, the magazine of spirituality, reality, and other conspiracies. And for Dharma Combat, we were getting in a lot of really great material that Jim didn't want to waste on a small circulation zine. So he wanted to go to a paperback quarterly, a magazine in paperback format that would come out four times a year. And he pitched this to a number of editors, and Adam Parfrey at Farrell House was interested, but he didn't want to do it as a quarterly. He didn't want to do it as a periodical. He wanted to do it as a one-shot book. And that book came out eventually as Secret and Suppressed, Hidden History and Banned Ideas. And that's kind of a funny story. Jim wrote an introduction to the book, and he hated the introduction. I thought it was perfectly fine, but he hated it. And as he was coming up to the last couple of days before he had to submit the final manuscript to Adam, he just threw it at me and said, "Here, you write it." So I took what he wrote and I was working on a book that has yet to come out called Toppling the Pyramid, A Practical Guide to Overthrowing the New World Order. So I took about half of his intro and half of what never appeared in that book and cobbled them together to make the introduction to Secret and Suppressed under Jim's pen name, which Adam Parfrey was livid when he discovered that had happened a few years later. Another oddity is that at the same time, in Dharma Combat, we had published a thing called the Skeleton Key to the Gemstone File.
Mm-hmm.
And the Skeleton Key to the Gemstone File had been circulating Samizdat, you know, as an underground secret publication in which people were Xeroxing it and handing each other to it and going to each other, wow, this is incredible stuff. The Skeleton Key purports to be, there was a guy named Bruce Roberts who said that he invented the technology for making artificial rubies. And he took the technology to Howard Hughes, and Hughes' company stole the technology, which really upset Bruce Roberts, and Bruce Roberts decided to get something on Hughes. So over the next several years, Bruce Roberts made his artificial rubies and then sold them as being real ones to raise cash to investigate Hughes. At one point, he had what became known as the Gemstone File, and this was about 1,000 letters that he'd written mostly to his mom and had kept copies of. And there was, you may remember, you may have heard of Mae Brussel, M-A-E Brussel.
No, I'm not.
Mae was the queen of conspiracy. She did a conspiracy show called Conspiracy Corner from a little radio station in Monterey, Carmel, California, for about 20 years. And indeed, she died of a fast-acting cancer identical to the one that Jack Ruby died of, and was convinced, like Jack Ruby, that she had been given it to take her out. And her primary area of research was connections between the JFK hit and the Nazis.
Really?
At one point, Bruce Roberts shows up at her home with a car filled with cardboard boxes filled with the 1,000 letters that he'd written his mom of his research into what Howard Hughes was all about. And when he showed up, it just happened that there was a person named Stephanie Caruana who was a reporter for Play Girl magazine. And Stephanie offered to take the files, put them in order, and write a synopsis. And that synopsis became known as the Skeleton Key to the Gemstone File. And in the Skeleton Key, it purports Bruce Roberts was convinced that he had discovered the truth about the JFK hit, which is why he brought it to Mae Brussel, and that he believed that Aristotle Onassis had actioned the assassination. He also believed that Aristotle Onassis had kidnapped Howard Hughes, kept him at his secret island Scorpios, and murdered him, and dumped the body in a secret funeral. When we published a copy of the Skeleton Key to the Gemstone File in Dharma Combat, we got contacted by this guy from Atlanta, Georgia, named Ron Bonds. And Ron had been collecting every known version of the Skeleton Key. Ron and Jim agreed to start a publishing company. Ron would be the editor-publisher, and the first book out of the gate would be an analysis of the Gemstone File. And this was Jim's second book, The Gemstone File, which was edited by Jim, and it was a collection of articles by a number of people, including Stephanie Caruana, of what this thing was, what it purported, whether it was true or not. And by the luck of the draw, you know, the publishing industry is very slow, and it took Farrell House, Adam Parfrey, about a year and a half to get Secret and Suppressed out. Meanwhile, Ron Bonds, not knowing how slow it's supposed to go in publishing, he whips out the Gemstone File, so Jim's second book actually is his first book, and his first book is actually his second book.
Right. Oh my God! So it's what was this the initial cooperation then that you guys began after you were writing the introduction here? Did this kind of set you off both to work more closely together?
Actually, we had been working very closely together. We had formed sort of a fiction factory, and we had written together. I lost track. We wrote under a variety of pen names. The pen name I liked the most was Michael Drax. Jim Keith was a huge fan of Lord Dunsany. Lord Dunsany wrote 180 fantasy novels, all with a quill pen. And this was after the invention of the typewriter, but he was a technophobe and hated typewriters, so he wrote 180 fantasy novels with a quill pen, which I thought was rather hilarious. And Lord Dunsany had a bunch of middle names, I don't know, 6, 8, 10, you know how British lords are.
Right,
and two of his middle names were Michael and Drax, so that was one of our pen names. And I think Jim sold 8 or 10 books under that title, or under that byline, in which Jim and I we worked out a deal where I did continuity and he did. Jim was really good at dialogue and internal dialogue, what people are thinking and feeling. He was really good at that. But in terms of the physical world, you know, it was just hilarious. He didn't have any interest in it. So a girl would walk into a room in a red dress, engage, you know, have a big argument scene with the people in the room, and then walk out of the room wearing a green dress. I mean, walk in red, walk out green, because Jim just didn't pay any attention.
Right.
So I would do the continuity on Jim's stories, and there were things like in one story he needed a really fancy mansion, so I designed the mansion and wrote up all the scenes for each of the rooms, and then he just plugged my descriptions in as he went through the case of the story.
Right.
So we were doing fairly good at that, but most of these were what are called works for hire, which is you get a flat payment and no royalties. You just get a one-time payment and it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the reasons why I lost track of how many of these I'd worked on, because I'd worked on, you know, pieces of books and got no royalties from them, so it wasn't really worth the bother of keeping track of them. So I really don't know how many books in total I have helped to write, 40, 50, something like that. So Jim and I were working on this fiction factory and doing Dharma Combat, and we set up the National UFO Museum in Reno, Nevada, in which I played the executive director and he played the chairman of the board, which meant basically he did nothing except harass me occasionally.
Right.
And I was the editor-in-chief of the quarterly journal, which came out about semi-annual instead of quarterly. We got out like 3 or 4 issues before Reaganomics and the last big U.S. recession took us out. Well, all of which led to our getting a lot of really good nonfiction material and a lot of good nonfiction writing under our belts.
Right.
And then when Jim got connected up with Ron Bonds, he cranked out several books for Ron, including the runaway bestseller Black Helicopters Over America, Strike Force with a New World Order.
Right, right.
And the sequel to it, Black Helicopters Over America, The Endgame Strategy. And Jim and I became very, very, I won't say active in, but very much aware of and surrounded by the militia movement, the extreme American right wing.
Right.
They seem to be the people, you know, we're getting all this conspiracy theory stuff, and the left wing of America was saying that the right wing was the conspiracy, and the right wing was saying the left wing were the conspiracy. It was hilarious.
Right.
And both sides this is the thing that I find amazing, is that if you listen closely, both sides are saying exactly the same thing.
Of course.
They're saying that there are fascists running our country who are stealing our rights from us.
Yeah, yeah.
And each side accuses the other side of being responsible for the fascists who are stealing our rights.
Exactly. Oh my God, it's a circus. That's what it is. You know.
Uh-huh.
Incredible.
So the way I got my first nonfiction book, the first one still has to be published. Jim got an invitation from Loompanics, who have since folded. Loompanics was both a mail order catalog and a publishing house, much like my publishing house that I'm working for now, Adventures Unlimited Press. And Loompanics was owned by Mike Loy, and Loy had this bright idea of doing a book called Strategies for Overthrow, which would be a collection of articles on how to legally overthrow the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim got this invitation, and Jim had me write an article under his byline. And what I wrote was called was Overthrowing the Secret Government, in which I maintained that there was a conspiracy, a high cabal, that ran the means of making wealth in the country.
Right.
And that if you didn't take them out, but that didn't matter what sort of administration you would put in, as long as they owned the stuff, they would simply buy whatever new government you put in place and own them just the way they own the current one.
Right. It doesn't matter which one is on the surface, so to speak, because people are not targeting the root of the problem, right?
Exactly. So they really liked the article, and it was slated to go in the book, and then at some point Mike Loy backed off and canceled the project, at which point I rewrote it into book length, which is the book that never got published, because when I finished the book length of it, Mike Loy wasn't interested in it, and I bounced it off a number of other publishers, and all of them were sort of interested, but not really, and this is topping the pyramid of Practical Guide to Overthrowing the New World Order.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by this time, Jim had already sold about 6 books, and he got a call in the summer of 96 from Ron Bonds, and Ron said, "Hey, HARP is the hottest thing on the internet right now. Can you write me a book on the subject?"
Uh-huh.
And Jim said, "No, I have 4 contracts working right now. I don't have the time, but I got a friend."
Right.
And so Jim put me in contact with Ron Bonds. We agreed to do a book on HARP. HARP is the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. Just so that your listeners who don't know what HARP is a field of antennas on the ground in southeastern Alaska that is so linked together as to work as one giant antenna, and is today the world's largest radio broadcasting station, the world's most powerful radio broadcasting station, with an effective radiated power of 3.6 million watts. But it's not designed to broadcast for human ears. It's designed to inject all of that energy into a spot at the top of the atmosphere in a region called the ionosphere. Now, when you inject that much energy into the ionosphere, and let me give you a clue how much that is. In the United States, the largest legal AM radio station is 50,000 watts.
Mm-hmm.
HARP is 72,000 50,000-watt radio stations, injecting their entire output into a spot about 12 miles across by about 2.5 miles deep by about 90 miles up.
Mm.
Now, when you do that, that heats that spot by several thousand degrees to the point where the molecules of the atmosphere literally explode. They are blown apart and give off a packet of energy. When you break up the molecules, they give off a packet of energy. And in this case, included in that packet of energy is a stream of ELF, extremely low-frequency radio waves, which penetrate deep into the earth and deep into the sea. And the U.S. Navy has been using HARP for about 15 years to communicate with deeply submerged submarines. The other side of this story is that when you blow the molecules apart, you convert them into something, into an electrically charged gas that is called a plasma. And this plasma, because it's at the top of the atmosphere where convection can take place, it goes out into space. So you get this plume of electrically charged gas going out into space, and it keeps going out until it runs into something to stop it, which is the magnetic lines of force of the Earth's magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
And when it reaches the magnetic lines of force, it gets trapped between them and spreads out, forming a shield of electrically charged gas that will disrupt or destroy anything passing through it, like an incoming ICBM.
Right.
HARP is a ground-based Star Wars weapon system. Of course, the people who are operating it deny that rather vigorously.
Yeah.
So anyhow, I got a go-ahead from Ron Bonds to write a book on HARP. I spent the summer of 96 first drafting it, sent the first draft to Ron, and he hated it and canceled the project.
Okay.
And I ended up setting on the book for a year, and then I remembered David Hatcher Childress at Adventures Unlimited Press and gave him a call, and he jumped at it because he was looking for a book on HARP.
Mm-hmm.
So there was one small problem. David wanted the final manuscript in 2 months.
Hmm.
So I actually did 5 major rewrites of the book in 2 months to clean up the problems that Ron had seen in it.
Hmm.
But I didn't have time to do any substantial structural changes on it, and Ron had wanted a conspiracy theory book. And indeed, my title for the book was HARP, the Ultimate Weapon, ?
Mm-hmm.
And Ron insisted it had to have the word conspiracy in the title, which is how it came out as HARP, the Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
And when I sold it to David didn't even blink at the word conspiracy, didn't register on him. So that was the book he bought. That was the book he got.
Mm.
And it became a major bestseller. It was it wasn't a New York Times bestseller, but in terms of small print runs, small publishing houses, it pretty much blew doors.
Right.
And was the one of the top bestsellers for this company for about 6 years.
Very good, very good. So you're
so we were talking about Jim.
Right.
While this was going on, of course, Jim was finishing his 12 books, which are all on UFO conspiracy mind control subjects. In fact, one of his books I think is best is Mind Control World Control, which is called An Encyclopedia of Mind Control, and it is pretty much the most you can know about that subject in one cover.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an amazing book. And there's a section on HARP, which he took from my manuscript that Ron didn't like, which I thought was kind of hilarious, that he got to rewrite me as opposed to the usual going the other way around.
Right, right.
And then Jim died. And this was rather tragic. Jim was something of a psychic. He believed in a number of odd things. He and I had both been in and out of Scientology. We both spent a decade in Scientology.
Really?
After Scientology, Jim went through a course in miracles, and then a Scientology offshoot group called Avatar. And Jim actually worked at a psychic hotline where people would call up, and he would do psychic readings with tarot cards, and he amazed himself at how accurate he was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He and I both have a mutual best friend, George Picard. George and I, some years after Jim's death, wrote together Secrets of the Holy Lance, The Spear of Destiny in History and Legend. Jim and George went to Burning Man, the annual art festival held in the Nevada desert.
Yeah.
And curiously, the day they left, Jim, who was doing runes at the time, did a reading and got the death rune. And he was shaken by it, but went anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that, absolutely convinced, he was going to die from going there, which I thought was rather odd.
Mm.
And indeed, at one point, late, probably around 2 in the morning, Sunday morning, George is a musician and had set in with a band called the Black Rock Rangers. And at some point, Jim and George realized that they're sitting on the stage where the Rangers had played, and everybody had gotten up and left, and they'd been so engrossed in talking to each other they hadn't noticed that they were the only people left, and decided, well, let's go someplace where there are people.
Right.
And they jumped down off the stage. George walked for a bit, turned to say something to Jim, and realized he wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
Looked back, and Jim was in a pile at the bottom of the stage. He'd gone down rather hard, and Jim was unsure if he'd sprained his knee or broke his knee or what, but it hurt like heck. George got the EMT, emergency medical people, to come over, take Jim to the medical tent. At the med tent, they couldn't decide whether he was broken or sprained, and recommended airlifting him into Reno. And you can almost see the dollar signs flashing across Jim's eyes at this point.
Mm-hmm.
As you're talking, you know, several thousand dollars to be care flighted into town.
Mm-hmm.
He said, no. And he talked George into driving him home, and all the way back, and from the Black Rock Desert where Burning Man takes place to Reno is about a 4.5-hour drive. And all the way back into town, George is trying to convince Jim to go to the hospital, and Jim is saying, no, I'll get over it.
Hmm.
It took Jim 45 minutes to crawl from George's car to his living room, and then spent the next several days in the middle of his living room.
Mm-hmm.
He had two preteen daughters at the time, and he ordered the daughters not to call the medics, the ambulance, or anything, so they didn't know what to do, so they called his sister. Now, his sister, and I hate to say this, his sister is a member of a extreme Christian religious group. Mm-hmm. When you join this group, you give everything you own, including your self-will, to the guru that leads the group, who speaks for God. And they called Aunt Kathy. Aunt Kathy drove down from Portland to Reno, which took most of a day.
Mm-hmm.
She arrived on, I believe, Wednesday, found him in the middle of the floor, took one look at him and said, "You're going to the hospital, Buster."
Hmm.
So she did call the ambulance. The ambulance took him. He got into the hospital on Wednesday, and the doctor said, "Now, he's been lying on the floor since dawn Sunday, and his body chemistry was off the charts, and they needed to stabilize him." The last non-medical person to see him alive was Jan, another mutual friend of ours, who came in Thursday afternoon just before he went into surgery.
Okay.
And Jan said that there were two physical therapists massaging his legs before they took him under. Now,
okay.
This is curious, in that if there were, what killed him was a blood clot.
Okay.
It would seem that these physical therapists massaged him to ensure releasing the blood clot.
Okay.
He was extremely sensitive to drugs and told the doctors that he absolutely refused to do a general anesthetic because he didn't think he'd come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And insisted they had to give him a local or he was going to crawl out of the hospital. They agreed, okay, we'll give you a local. They took him in and they gave him a general.
Mm.
Now, the newspaper story made it sound that he died of a blood clot to the lung. The official spokesperson for the hospital said that this is a fairly common occurrence. One of the great conspiracy radio hosts is Dr. Stan Monteith.
Right.
Dr. Monteith is, what, in his late 70s now. He worked his entire life as a medical doctor. I talked about this with Dr. Monteith, and he said that he had performed that procedure more than 32,000 times and had never lost a patient.
Hmm, that's quite a lot.
There were some other curious aspects of this. The newspaper story made it sound like Jim died in the OR, but from talking to hospital employees, we discovered that he made it out of OR and was in ICU when he died.
Mm-hmm.
To this day, we do not know if he ever regained consciousness or not.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the peculiar aspects, you know, is one of his major books was Black Helicopters Over America, Strike Force for the New World Order, which documents covert low-level spraying of toxic substances on people.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, MSNBC sent a film crew out to film Jim, and when they got here, they discovered that Jim and I had put together a circle of writers, researchers, paranoids to help with our research, and that this circle of researchers meets every Saturday night in a local restaurant. And indeed, it still meets to this day every Saturday night in a local restaurant.
Okay.
At this point, it's meeting in the banquet room at the back of the Denny's on Nugget Avenue in Sparks, Nevada. And if anybody out there wants to drop in, they'll be happy to welcome you in. They start gathering around 5. The meeting more or less gets started around 6 p.m. And this again is the Nugget Avenue Denny's in Sparks, Nevada.
Nice.
If you want to join in, just tell them I sent you. So when MSNBC heard about this group, they decided to film the group too. So they brought the cameras to the local restaurant and started filming.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who was in the restaurant having dinner saw this, came over, asked what was going on, and when he learned that it was about black helicopters, he announced to the film crew, "Well, I've been in one."
Mm-hmm.
And they filmed him and interviewed him talking about having tripped around inside of a black helicopter.
Okay.
Well, the reason I mention this is because when Jim was in the OR, this same person was in the OR as an OR nurse.
Hmm.
Which all of us found rather strange.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm.
So I believe that at the very least it was medical malpractice.
Okay.
And it seems to me like it was engineered medical malpractice.
Hmm. And why was Jim so? Do you know why Jim was so? He obviously he did not want to go to the hospital. Was that only because of money, or because he has a general idea that, you know, doctors won't listen to him and they are, you know, generally incompetent or what?
Well, actually, it's much more fundamental and bizarre than that. Jim simply had a thing about fixing things. Jim never fixed anything, period.
Okay.
To give you an example, at the time he died, neither of the doors on his mobile home would actually shut. About a third of the windows were broken out.
Okay.
Most of the shelves in the kitchen had collapsed. The toilet never stopped running, and water didn't come out of the shower. It was just Jim didn't fix anything.
Yeah.
One of my favorite stories of Jim not fixing things is that at one point he'd had an office downtown and had to move his office back into the home trailer because his father had had a triple heart bypass and never really recovered from it, and he ended up having to babysit his father. And when he got moved back into the trailer, the screen had gotten really, really tiny. That it was like only the text was only appearing in like a third of the screen. And Jim, for the next 6 months, had his nose up against the monitor trying to read what was going on. I came by one day, between the two of us, he was the only one who had a printer, and I came by to print some letters for the National UFO Museum. I work on his computer for about a minute, and I can't take looking at this tiny type.
Right.
So I called the company he got the computer from and explained the problem. And they go, oh, yeah. On the back, there's a tiny toggle switch to toggle the monitor from color to monochrome. And it probably got toggled the wrong way. Just reach back there, find the switch, toggle it over, you're fine.
Mm.
So I said, thank them. I reached back, found it, click, boom, here's the screen back to full size.
Right.
Jim had suffered for 6 months. It took me 3 minutes to solve the problem. But Jim simply didn't fix anything. So when Jim got broken, Jim wasn't going to fix Jim either.
Ah, so that's the way it was. Okay, I mean, sheesh, that doesn't sound too good, though. I mean, it's when it comes to his character, when it comes to the research, though, would you say that is totally different and he was very methodical, or was he the same?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Jim was a genius. And you know the problem with geniuses.
Yeah, sure.
When Jim took his SATs, he scored in the top 1% of the top 1%.
Mm-hmm.
He could have gotten a scholarship to go to any college he wanted to. He was absolute screaming genius. And this is very odd. I maturated in a group of absolute screaming geniuses. Most of my friends were certified 180 plus IQs.
Mm-hmm.
And I have sort of an inferiority complex because I was always the dumbest person in the room.
Right. Oh my God. But I mean, so you, what you're saying here also that you're surrounded by a lot of, you know, in a way then eccentric personalities, but brilliant in their own way.
Exactly, very eccentric. And of course, this was a group of boys from, I met them all when we were all in our mid-teens.
Right, right.
You know, I was 16, Jim was 17 when I met him.
Mm-hmm.
I hung out with this group for about 10 years. In fact, it was odd that the group blew apart around 72, 74. And we didn't see each other from then till Jim's death. And then another one of the screaming geniuses who, his IQ is slightly higher than Jim's. And the two of them were constantly harassing each other about which of them was the brighter of the two. After Jim's death, this other fellow, also Jim, put the group back together on the internet and created a Yahoo group and went out and found us and brought us back together, and we've been harassing each other for what, 8 years now.
Sounds good. I just wanted to go backtrack a little bit and talk about the Scientology part. Did you and Jim were members for a little while but then dropped out? What happened there?
Oh boy, this is a very long story, and I'm not sure I really want to go into it. Basically, what happened is Jim and I were doing a critically acclaimed amateur magazine in 70 to 72, 69 to 71, somewhere in that general zone.
Mm-hmm.
And we got an article, and we were members of the Valley Science Fiction Association. Jim was one of the founders of it, and we were members. I'm still a member of the Los Angeles Science Fantasy Society, the oldest science fiction club in the country. It's met every Thursday night since 1936. I'm required to say that whenever I mention them. So Jim and I were very much connected to the science fiction fandom movement,
mm-hmm.
and we were doing a science fiction fanzine, and it turns out that an early dieteticist, a guy who had been with Hubbard in the 50s, was also a member of the Lospus. In fact, Hubbard was a member of the Lospus, though his last time he attended was probably about 10 years before the first time we attended. We got this article from Jack Harness, who everybody called Jack Harmless. The article was entitled Nonfiction, and it was bits and pieces of Jack Harness's last 3 billion years worth of reincarnations.
Okay.
With between them explanations of how Dianetics worked to help him to remember these past lives.
Okay.
Well, I read the article, and I was sort of impressed, but not really. But Jim was just blown away by it. And over the next couple of years, Jim read everything he could get his hands on about Scientology,
mm-hmm.
and then ended up joining staff at the Scientology local church in Riverside, California. That ended up sort of messily in that his girlfriend got stolen by another staff member, and Jim was a very emotional person. He was a great poet. He wrote literally tens of thousands of poems. One of the things that Jim never forgave me for was at one point Jim Keith and Jim Schumacher moved together to the Haight-Ashbury. We were living, we grew up in Southern California, and then Jim and Jim moved to the Haight. And one day I went by Jim's house and discovered that the floor of his closet was about 8 inches deep in poems. There must have been 3,000 poems on the floor of his closet.
Mm-hmm.
So I went through them and picked out 200 I liked and published them.
Right.
Jim hated them. That's why they were on the floor of his closet, which is why he never forgave me for publishing them.
Oh, wow, what a story. So, I mean, it's... So you guys were down there, but then, it feels weird that someone who is so astute, so to speak, when it comes to conspiracy actually joins Scientology. It's kind of an oxymoron to me. What's your take on that?
Well, this is something it's really hard to explain.
Okay.
Scientology is an absolutely brilliant cut and paste, and it in very large part, it is the successful con that it is because it does what it says it does. The problem is that it does something else as well. It does help you to understand your own mind, your own spirit. It does help you to become more able in many aspects and areas of life. But it also installs hypnotism, and has all the drawbacks and downsides of a hypnotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reluctant to say too much about this because I'm treading on you'll get sued if you go there. And Scientology has 99 lawyers on retainer. Scientology is absolutely infamous for suing its critics out of existence.
Okay.
And so I don't want to say anything rude about Scientology because I plan to still be alive for another 20 years or so.
God. But can you say this much? Did Jim and yourself drop out of the movement or are you still connected with it?
Well, yeah, no, we both left. We
right.
both left Scientology. There were a number of things that, and the apparent good is very brilliant when you first come in, and the downsides, the wrongnesses, slowly sneak up on you, slowly realize, well, that doesn't seem right, and this doesn't seem right, and it takes a while to piece together what the problem is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Eventually, we did piece it together and realized that it wasn't entirely what it said it was, and moved on to other things. But mm-hmm. Jim still stayed more a believer than not a believer, which is why he practiced Avatar, which I describe as Scientology light.
Hmm. Right, right. It's an offshoot of Scientology?
Yes, yes. And Scientology calls anybody who practices Scientology but spins it to do it their way, mm-hmm. as opposed to the standard required way, those people are called squirrels. And a squirrel who sets up a group to do some variation on Scientology and something else, or Scientology their way as opposed to the standard way, that's called a squirrel group.
Mm-hmm.
So Avatar is one of several hundred squirrel groups.
Right, right, I see. Now I do want to get into, you know, how all of this research and so forth that you guys were doing back then kind of a little bit connects with what you have been picking up on consequently after that. But we have, you know, I think we should do like this, that we should actually begin to talk a little bit about your upcoming appearance on Beyond Conference, Beyond Knowledge Conference, before we begin to round things up here for our first segment. And I do want to mention here then that Jerry E. Smith will be attending this conference. This is the 3rd and 4th of May. Beyond Knowledge Conference is taking place in Liverpool, England. This is definitely something for our British and European friends out there. And Jerry Smith will be a speaker with some other fine fellow researchers like David Hatcher Childress, Marcus Allen, Michael Tesserion, Ken Thomas, Ralph Ellis, Ian Crane, and David Griffin. So it's quite a nice crew there. It's going to be an exciting event. And I want to mention that those who are interested in attending the conference can find out much more information about it going to the following website here, beyond-knowledge.co.uk. That's beyond-knowledge.co.uk. And Jerry, you'll be there, as I said, and you'll be... What topics are you going to cover at the conference?
I'm going to be talking about weather warfare. My newest book is Weather Warfare, The Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature. And I'm going to be... giving the very low highlights out of the book, you know, such things as the history of weather modification, including it being used as a weapon by the U.S. military during the Vietnam War, little things like earthquakes on demand, the attempts to steer and control hurricanes, and other stranger things.
Right, right. Yeah, so as I said, it's going to be a fascinating conference, a lot of people there. And what day are you going to be speaking on? Which one of the two?
I believe I'm the first speaker after lunch, the first day, Saturday, the 3rd of May.
Right, right. So again, let me point out the website there, beyond-knowledge.co.uk. Jerry Smith and a whole lot of other interesting researchers are going to be there. Myself and Fredrik will also be there. We will not do any talk, but we definitely want to meet up with some of the good folks there and listen to some of these fine speakers about their interesting research. So do check it out, definitely. Jerry, I think we should do like this. We'll take a little short break here, and we'll continue our discussion in the member section. But for this segment, I want to thank you very much for coming on. But before that, though, I want to ask you to give out your website so people can find a little bit more about yourself and also about some of the books that you have written.
Certainly. My name is Jerry E. Smith. That's Jerry with a J, J-E-R-R-Y, middle initial E, last name Smith. And my website is all one word, no punctuation, jerryesmith.com. At jerryesmith.com, you will find a section on each of the books I've written, which includes such things as the table of contents, reviews, the bibliography, articles, quite a variety of things, so you can get a better feeling for what the book is about and what other people think of the book. Also, you'll find an archive of articles I've written, a book of my poetry, a biographical section about me, and some other cool things, including a big section on Adventures Unlimited Press, which includes a list of all the titles we've published, the World Explorers Club. I'm back at this very moment. I'm in the World Explorers Club World Headquarters and Clubhouse here in Kempton, Illinois.
Excellent. And that's is it David Hatcher-Childress who's behind that, right?
Exactly. David is the owner, founder, president, editor-in-chief, and at one point a few years ago, I asked him what title he went by, and he rattled off a whole list of them and then said, but I haven't used Generalissimo for several years now.
There we go.
That's a joke.
Exactly. I got you. Okay, so let's do like this then. We'll take a short little break right here, and we'll continue talking more in the member section. But for this segment, thank you very much, Jerry.
Well, thank you, and I hope we get into the worldwide conspiracy when we come back.
Definitely. Tune into our continuation of our discussion with Jerry E. Smith, as we'll get into how the Green Movement connects with global warming, global government, and weather warfare. Our website is redicecreations.com. Click on subscribe and tune in. On Thursday, we're going to have Ralph Ellis with us on the program. Thank you for listening. We'll talk more after this break.